Well, this evening we'll be taking a little bit of a break from our study of church discipline, mostly because with me being away at that conference all week and in sessions basically 12 hours a day, it seemed like, and that's not much of an exaggeration with the exceptions of eating here and there. I didn't have the time that I wanted to do justice to study of that topic, so I thought we'd come back and talk about that next time and do something else in the meantime. And Charlie gave me a little bit of an idea this morning in class as we were talking about Rahab that also reminded me of just how long we've been going to 58th Street now. I hadn't thought about it in a while as to how long we've been here, but way back at the beginning, back in 2008, I started teaching a class on Genesis, and when we came to the story of Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai at that point, going down to Egypt in Genesis chapter 12, there came to be something of a question as to the morality of what was going on in that scene where Abram said, "She is my sister." And that led to something of a lengthy discussion of this issue of lying and deception in the Old Testament, which made me stop and think, that was 2008, that's been a long time. And a lot of the people that were here for that study then are not here anymore, and a lot of you who are here now weren't here for that study then. So I thought, kind of dovetailing off of the end of Charlie's class and saving me from doing a poor job of talking about church discipline, we could go back to that study this evening and really conduct it as much like a Bible class as anything. What I'd like to do is we'll talk about a few examples of where this happens in the Old Testament. I'll run you through a list of various proposals that I've come across as to making sense of this and give you opportunity on each one to maybe offer some pros and cons as to what you think merits or lack thereof there may be in these suggestions. And then we'll kind of slow down a little bit and look at each of these cases in particular. So that's kind of where we're going in relation to this issue of lying and deception in the Old Testament. So the three examples that we'll look at this evening, and we'll take some time to read them briefly before we go too much further, are the issues of Abraham and Isaac, who each will say of their spouse, "She's my sister." We'll just for the sake of time read a little bit out of Genesis 12, but Abraham will do it again in Genesis chapter 20 with a different king, one named Abimelech, and then Isaac will do it again with probably a later generation of a Philistine king named Abimelech as well in chapter 26. We talked about Rahab this morning as she is hiding the spies, and so we'll spend some time thinking about that. And then also there's a case where Samuel will do something along these lines in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And the question really is not just, is this moral, you know, good moral or bad moral kind of thing to do? Because if you just read across these, and there's no comment, no moral commentary, nothing else going on, you'd say, well, they're liars and they made mistakes. The problem is that it seems, at least on some level, that there is some kind of approval of what's going on here. So, in reverse order, Samuel is explicitly commanded by God to say what he is going to say. Rahab is commended as a person of faith, directly related to what she does in this case. And Abram, when he leaves, in Genesis chapter 12 at least, but then also in Genesis chapter 20 as well, he winds up very much enriched at the end of the story. He's far wealthier at the end of the story than he was at the beginning of the story. So he seems to have been blessed as a result of what happens, and he certainly is never condemned in the Bible, nor is Isaac when he follows his father's footsteps. And so that's what leads it to be a little bit of a dilemma as to what's going on here. And there are probably other passages we could lump into this kind of category as well, but these will more than suffice for the time that we have this evening. So with that little bit of backdrop, turn to Genesis chapter 12, and we'll start there this evening. And then what we'll do is just read through each of these very quickly to get them in our mind as to what's going on. Genesis chapter 12, we'll just read verses 10 through 13 because that's the gist of what happens here. They've just arrived in the promised land after being called by God to leave, and it says there was famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. And he goes on, and they proceed to do that, and he says that she's a sister, and that's the same thing that will happen in chapter 20, same thing that will happen again in chapter 26. All right, Joshua 2, it's the text we were taking our Bible class from this morning. Joshua has sent the spies into the land, and they go to the house of Rahab. And picking up in verse 2, it was told to the king of Jericho, behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, true, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of the flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. And the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. And then they go on to make the oath with Rahab about sparing her family. And finally, in 1 Samuel chapter 16. This is the point where Saul has been utterly rejected from being king after his failure to wipe out the Amalekites, as he should have in chapter 15. And it says at the end of chapter 15 that after this point, Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. And so this is the breaking of contact between Samuel and Saul. And Samuel is here told to go anoint a new king. So 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 1, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king from among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you. Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him, trembling, and said, do you come peaceably? And he said, peaceably, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And so here God says, go anoint me a new king. And Samuel says, Saul's going to kill me. And God says, ah, just say you're going to offer a sacrifice. At least maybe that's one tone in which you could read that. But it does seek to avoid the what is apparently the real issue of what's going on. So what do we make of these stories? How do we solve what is at least apparently a difficulty between dishonesty among the people and apparent moral praise of what's going on or direct commandment from God of what to say? Well, I've got five different solutions that I've come across that we'll kind of go through one at a time and for now at least try to keep the discussion located to the one that we're talking about. And if I don't get to one that you may have in mind, we can certainly add that toward the end. One of the most recent things, well, not very recent now, but in terms of the list of things I have, probably the latest addition to it, was to make some kind of distinction between two different things here. You've got, on the one hand, lying, which apparently is some kind of blatant, clear falsehood, and deception, which is something different, which is misleading someone by means of half-truths or other non-explicit lies. And so if you make a distinction between these two different things, maybe it's like sin level one and sin level two, and in some circumstances perhaps sin level two is okay or something. I'm not exactly sure how this all works itself out in terms of the nuts and bolts, but I have heard this as a solution. Abraham wasn't lying, he merely deceived them, was nearly an exact quote of what I heard at one point along these lines. So, before I tell you what I have to say about this, any thoughts about this solution to our conundrum?
Usually a half-truth is a lie.
Okay. What I might say about that is it depends entirely on the purpose of the half-truth. We say a lot of times that half-truths are lies. I've heard preachers say all half-truths are lies. And I would not go that far, but I think what they mean is all half-truths that are used to deceive are lies. You think about the situation between Abraham and Sarah, right? So you've got two parts of the true relationship between Abraham and Sarah. One part is that she is his half-sister, and another part is that she is his spouse. So when he goes to Egypt and into the Philistine region and says, she's my sister, and ignores the part about her being his wife, he's trying to deceive. And so I would say that's a lie. But think about all the other times that Abraham's just living his life and says, this is my wife, but excludes the fact that she's also his half-sister. That is every bit as much a half-truth as the other situation is, because he is still telling half of the situation. But none of us would say, oh, that's a half-truth. I mean, technically it is, but what we mean when we say half-truth, what Brother Winton's referring to, is a half-truth that is meant to deceive somebody. And when Abraham left the part out about her being his half-sister, it's probably just irrelevant most of the time, and that's why he doesn't mention it. But when it's extremely relevant and you ignore it to deceive somebody, that's what we're talking about in terms of a half-truth being a lie. Charlie? Yeah, and really what he's trying to make them think is something that is 100% not true. So the means by which he goes about doing that, and I what I would say is you can use 100% truth in such a way to lead someone to a wrong conclusion, and that's as much of a lying spirit as telling a flat-out lie. I hesitate to speak too much for God on that, but it sure seems that way to me that would be the case. Jonathan? Right, and that.
I think that if what the, at least in general, normal life, what God values, what God wants from us is that we speak truth. That kind of negates trying to parse out this narrow distinction of, well, it wasn't an absolute false statement that he said; it was a lie, so it was okay.
Right, and that goes to something Tom's spoken about, at least on a couple of occasions. That you've got these parallel grouped ideas in Ephesians when Paul is kind of hammering out the nuts and bolts of what this Christian life looks like, where you've got don't do this, but do this paired ideas. And the one on this is, you know, don't lie to one another, but speak the truth in love, which is more than just speaking in that context. We just don't have a good English word to say truthing, but it would certainly include speaking the truth. And so it's not merely avoiding the lie, but it's actively speaking the truth as well. And this certainly would fail to live up to that.
I'm not aware of any linguistic basis you can distinguish
no.
lying and deception, and especially in the Greek. So
right.
It's just dubious from the get-go.
Yeah.
Well, in this situation, to apply this distinction in Abraham's instance, it seems as if the person who's making this distinction is trying to make Abraham a good person. mm-hmm. make it okay for Abraham to do this. Whereas in the story, it seems pretty clear to me, at least, that this is something Abraham should not have done. If you try to apply it to the other two situations, the situation with Rahab, it doesn't say anything about the spies having gone out, unless you want to infer that, oh, they must have... Surely they didn't come to her house and then stay there the entire time. So her statement that they had gone out was a half-truth, and that they probably went in and out all or something.
Yeah.
And then with Samuel's instance, they maybe he did do a sacrifice. The Bible just didn't say he actually ended up doing one.
Well, yeah, that's something I think is worth saying, is that this would only definitely work as a solution, presuming there was any validity to it at all. It could only work with Abraham and Samuel because, I mean, Rahab, it says that she was hiding them on the roof of her house, like, right then. So I'd say, yeah, Rahab is clearly telling a blatant falsehood in relation to that. Right. Yeah. All right. Well, one other thing on this is something that seems to be built into this is this kind of hierarchy of sins, you might say, where lying is a really bad thing and deception is not quite as bad as lying is. To that, I would say Psalm 5 says the Lord abhors deceitful men. Psalm 24 says, who can go to the holy hill? Well, one of the qualifications of that is one who is without deceit. Proverbs 24 says, don't deceive with your lips. Jeremiah 5 says, you know, why are we being punished? Well, because your houses are full of deceit. Jeremiah 9, deceit is equated with a refusal to know God. Zephaniah 3, the righteous remnant who will return are people without deceitful tongues. In Mark 7, in Romans 1, deceit is listed with other kinds of wickedness and sin. 1 Peter 2, we're told to put away deceit. And among those who are called deceivers in the Bible include false teachers in 2 Corinthians 11, antichrists in 2 John, and Satan in Revelation 12. So to make a distinction between lying and deceit under the presumption that deception is not as bad as lying really flies in the face of everything the Bible has to say about deceiving. So this solution as a solution, I really don't think it does much by way of offering us any kind of help at all. Yes, sir.
God may have allowed these things to happen to further his greater cause.
Yeah, and God certainly is not above using humans' freely chosen wickedness to accomplish his purposes. That speaks to the great sovereignty and power of God, as it doesn't matter if you're on his side or not. You can be fighting against him with everything that you have, and he'll still use you to accomplish his goals. And you can see that in a variety of perspectives. But yeah, you know, does God need Rahab to lie to protect the spies? Absolutely not. Will he use that? Well, sure. Just like he uses wicked kings to punish other nations, or he used Judas to accomplish the salvation of all of mankind, or wherever you may go down those lines. So that's a good point as well to think about God's sovereignty along these lines.
I mean, along the same line, it's a mistake for us to read the outcome of the story, how Abraham's blessed and enriched, and conclude, therefore, what he did was correct. Any more than later when Israel comes out of Egypt and they're enriched and blessed by God, and that's an endorsement of Israel's character. They must have been a wonderful group of people.
Yeah.
I think it shows that God is still merciful and gracious toward us in spite of our faults.
You could think of a variety of examples of people.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, and not much enriching, but you might say Judas was enriched a little bit after he sold Jesus to the Jewish leaders, even. Well, God's blessing him. You know, he's 30 pieces of silver richer.
Yeah, I think you can take this passage and say, okay, it's okay to lie under certain circumstances. Or you could say, look at the Bible says it's okay to lie. And you're assuming that what Abraham did there was okay. But in this case, did it just represent lack of faith? Listed up as a symbol of faith. what he did here. I mean, this wasn't one of the Bibles. It's Abraham's picked out the New Testament as being exemplary because he lied about his wife.
Right, yeah. By faith, Abraham lied about his wife. Yeah, that verse isn't in there. Charlie, one more comment, then we'll move on.
What I would point out is, especially with Abraham and Rahab, you assume to distinguish between lying and deception. You assume that they were in the right for doing it, first and foremost, because at that point you'd be like, oh, well, then he must have been deception because it wasn't lying. Because if you were on the other side, if you're on the Pharaoh, if you're on the king side, they'd be like, you lied. I mean, Pharaoh clearly said, why did you tell me your sister? Because you clearly get a wife.
Yeah. And that's, you think about that, that's got to be one of the low points in Abraham's life spiritually, is when he's standing there silently because he has no defense, receiving a moral rebuke from a uncircumcised pagan king. I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that in his life. Well, let's move on. Another way of looking at this is something of what I've termed a times of ignorance kind of way of looking at this. And what I mean when I say that is to say that there are some things that you find in the Old Testament that God never intended, but he did allow and regulate and legislate under the old law. Now, of course, Abraham's living prior to the old law, but think of this in broader terms, just in terms of things that God did allow. So, for example, does God want divorce? No. Does God want divorce in any circumstance? No. Does he allow it in the case of adultery? Yes. But I'd say even then probably God's not thrilled with it happening because now you've got even more problems going on with that family. But be that as it may, God allows it for more than just that under the Old Testament. You think of issues like bigamy and polygamy. That's not something God has ever wanted. You know, what Jesus says is, from the beginning, have you not read from the beginning, this is how it was supposed to be. Not Adam and Eve and, you know, Judy and Mary, but Adam and Eve. It was just the two of them, and that's the way it was supposed to be from the beginning. Yet there are laws that allow that. God legislated that kind of situation because it was going on. You know, times of ignorance God overlooked. Jesus talks about divorce being because of the hardness of their hearts, but that's not how he wanted it. He wasn't necessarily happy with it, but he allowed it. So, maybe that's what's going on here, that this is a situation God's not exactly thrilled with, but he is permitting it to accomplish some kind of purpose otherwise. What are your thoughts here? Any thoughts here?
He's already, at this point, said, don't lie.
Okay. 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 Yeah, I'd say the biggest problem with this approach is you have to have some kind of allowance and regulation of it for it to be something that God is allowing and regulating. Everything that God says about lying and deception in the Old Testament is to strictly forbid it. Whether it's bearing false witness in the Ten Commandments, whether it's that multiplicity of verses I've already alluded to, or other verses like that that don't use the word deceit, which is what I was looking for specifically when I was constructing that list. It's very clear that this is not something that God is allowing and regulating and legislating, and I just don't think that this fits at all under that kind of heading. And so this, to me, doesn't carry a whole lot of weight either. I don't know how much we have to converse about this point, but any thoughts? This one seems a little bit more straightforward. All right. Perhaps a second cousin to this particular view is to say, well, that was the Old Testament, and God did things differently back then. Which, again, is not to say specifically that God allowed it and regulated it under the old law situation, but just things were very different under the Old Testament than they are now. And again, I think this pretty clearly, and we really don't have to discuss this one at all, I don't think, unless someone just wants to say something. This just flies in the face of everything else. You've got explicit laws against this Therefore, you can't say that was the Old Testament and things were different back then, when there are plenty of laws against this particular issue. Now, I would agree that things are different between the old law and the new law, and we can't rush to apply New Testament principles to Old Testament situations all of the time. But although the law has changed, God has not changed. The specifics of the ritual system may have changed, but what God wants internally out of people, that has not changed at all. And even the specific ritual situations, they're still there. They've just been modified and seen more fully. They're no longer shadows. You know, people will say, well, we don't have sacrifices anymore. Oh, yes, we do. They're just not animal sacrifices offered on an altar in Jerusalem. There are still sacrifices, and we could probably spend the next 5 minutes listing different kinds and ways that we sacrifice now. And so, fundamentally, the law may be different, but God is who God is. He has not changed. And again, the fact that lying and deceit are very clearly condemned in the Old Testament makes this one a difficult position to hold. Sam? Yeah, I think I have basically the idea of what you're getting at. Yeah, I'd say maybe a little yes and no on there, and I think the foundational principle that you're making is a very sound point, that that the purpose of the Old Testament is not necessarily to give us a list of moral tales that we are to follow precisely from beginning to end. Now, the only caveat I'd have to that is that there are some places where I think very clearly we are to follow their examples. And when you have the New Testament pointing back and saying, here's a fantastic example of faith, then you can look in those instances and find something along those lines there. But to indiscriminately say, these are all great stories and examples for us to follow, which I think is really your main point, yeah, I absolutely agree. Now, something else that goes along that line that's worth thinking about is to stop and say, how many times does the narrator stop mid-narrative and give a moral evaluation of what's going on in the text in the Old Testament? You know, how many times, you know, will the narrator say, you know, okay, and then this person committed adultery. And just so everybody's clear on this, that's a really bad thing for him to have done. Well, they don't do that. I mean, sometimes it will become clear in the context or because of something that is said that there is very much a sin there. It comes very clear in the case of David and Bathsheba that it was a sin, although it may, I'd have to go back and look at it. It's been a while. I don't know that it stops and offers that moral evaluation right in the middle of the narrative. You come to that conclusion later on, if I remember correctly, though I could be wrong on that. But certainly there are plenty of cases where there's no moral evaluation made. We have to understand enough about who God is and what God wants to be able to make that moral evaluation for ourselves as we read through the text. And so to say, you know, Abraham was blessed and he was never condemned, therefore he must have been doing something that was good, is not a justifiable conclusion to come to beyond all doubt. Now, there may be some way you can come to that conclusion, but not just because he's never condemned and he is blessed. Charlie?
The other thing I would point out, and we'll go back to the as well, because by this point there is no, you know, quote, Old Testament. But when we're talking about Abraham and Genesis 12, it leads to the point of how was the generation before the flood condemned, and then how is any generation after that, you know, until you get to Mount Sinai. How can God choose, oh, you're doing this wrong, or you're doing this wrong? Or how can mankind, in general, know what's righteous and what's wicked if there is no set morals, if there is no set law, even if it's not from God? I mean, people who don't recognize religion in any standpoint realize that lying and deception is
That's a good point as well. I mean, you don't find cultures anywhere that say it's okay to just say whatever you want to say to somebody and take advantage of them by means of deception. That's just not a standard of any culture, regardless of how godless they may have been. Jonathan? All right, moving to the next one, and this one can perhaps take a variety of specific kinds of perspectives, but we might lump all sorts of specific explanations under the heading that not all deceit and lying is always wrong. Now, that might sound like a difficult kind of thing to defend, but one way that this has been suggested is something along the lines of, if God can command his people to kill, and that's okay, then surely he can command his people to deceive, and that would be okay as well. Or another way that this is defined is to say, well, you think about the circumstances of what's going on. In the case of war, for example, you are not speaking the truth to your adversary. You know, what God would have us to do is speak the truth and not deceive, and so we need to go send some of our people over to our enemies across the battlefield and say, hey, I just want you to know, tomorrow morning we're planning on attacking on your left flank, and so just to make sure y'all are ready for that. So Joshua should have been sending these spies into the land, not to spy it out, but to tell everybody exactly what they're going to be doing when they come into the land and how they're going to try to defeat them. Well, no, they don't do that. What they do is they keep the information to themselves, and if they can deceive in some way, such as Gideon making the Midianite army think that they were just surrounded by all kinds of adversaries when they weren't really there, Gideon deceived them in that military tactic. So maybe in some circumstances like that, deception, strategy, tactics is part of what's going on. And so in other circumstances, that could be okay as well. So there's at least a couple of ways that this umbrella heading of not all deceit and lying is wrong could be played out. Something along the lines of military strategy on the one hand, and God's command to kill being okay, therefore God's command to lie may be okay as well. There's a couple ways of thinking about that. Jonathan?
Joshua 8, God actually is the one who gives them the battle plan to ambush the city from the
front. Okay.
Pretend like they're running away and then turn back and ambush it.
Okay.
So that's again another example of God endorsing some, in some situations, some sense of misleading.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, the difference between an outright deceiving and allowing somebody to draw their own conclusion. If you sit there quietly, you're not deceiving somebody. You may allow them to draw their own conclusions about something. You're not lying to them, you're not deceiving, you're just not giving them information. But from a military standpoint, by them not, you know, laying out their battle plan, it's not deception.
Okay.
It's just allowing them to draw their own conclusion. With killing, you assume that what they're doing is because the person wants to kill the other person. Granted, at that point, it's, you know, survival instinct, but
right. Of course, the whole war question and Christians fighting and pacifism and all that's a whole much bigger issue that we should try not to get into all of that tonight, I hope. At least some people think that there's a significant difference between killing on the battlefield in war and, you know, breaking into your neighbor's house and shooting them when they're asleep. Not everyone does, though. There are some people that would say there's absolutely no difference at all in those two things. So I don't know if anyone here has any strong feelings on that, and I'm not asking. I'm just clarifying that different people have different views on that particular issue. Stephen, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just thinking that what Charlie said is to say from the other perspective is that that's still not telling the truth, and so it's still not what we're meant to do.
Okay.
I mean, I still understand your point.
Yeah, well, and that's, I think we would need to be a little careful, at least, as to how far we go down that road. I could very easily see us taking the principle of, well, I just let them draw his own conclusions to justify all kinds of misbehavior on our part. And so, while there may be something to say in regard to that, particularly in terms of battle strategy and stuff, just be careful in terms of applying that principle too broadly. Well, one other thing that I'd say is specifically in terms of this issue of, you know, God has, if God can command them to kill, then God can command them to lie. Well, I guess two things I'd say about that. First of all, that is only applicable to Samuel of our three cases, because God does not command Abraham to say anything. He does not command Rahab to say anything. So if that is a solution, it's a small solution to one particular issue. The other thing that I'd say about that is I don't think that's the solution anyway, specifically, because there's a very big difference between someone dying and someone being deceived. And the reason I'd say there's a difference in that as it relates to God is to just stop and think about the nature of God. Where does all life come from? It all comes from God. And who is in charge of all life while it is alive? And under whose watch does all life end? God. And so you can say very easily, and I think very biblically, soundly, theologically soundly, that the giving and taking of life is God's prerogative, and it is part of the very essence of God's nature as it relates to mankind. And whether someone dies at 30, 40, 50, 80, 100, God is in charge of that death no matter when it happens. The giving and taking of life is under God's watch. It is part of His nature. Lying and deceit are not at all a part of God's nature. And so I think there's something fundamentally different about those two particular issues just based on the nature of God Himself. Now, God does say don't kill, and it's a sinful thing to kill your neighbor. And so that certainly would have to be worked into this as well. But I think there is something to be said for those two things being different. Now, what I'd say about this across the board as a solution, as a big umbrella kind of solution, is that this has the danger of the old slippery slope thing. And I really don't like to bring the slippery slope into discussions because, I mean, that can be a very bad argument, a poor approach to something. Well, if you do that, then that's going to lead to this, which could lead to this, which could lead to this. And then 300 years from now, we could just have sin all over the place. Well, you know, that's probably not the best argument everywhere. But if you just look at, well, not all lying and deceit's wrong, that's not 300 years removed from situation ethics and people trying to justify everything they say to deceive somebody else. And so there is the danger of this leading to a situation ethics approach to life, or the danger of leading to an ends justifies the means way of thinking and living as well. And so, you know, across the board, I'd be very hesitant about this approach. Now, is there something to be said for military strategy being different from how you normally conduct yourself with your neighbor? Absolutely. How far do you apply that? You know, does that work itself into the situation of Abraham and Sarah in Egypt? Well, probably not. And so, again, even specific examples of how this might work itself out in some circumstances, I'd say we should probably be very hesitant to try to endorse it as an across-the-board ethic to approaching these kinds of situations.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. You can give the example of, you know, you're in World War II Germany, and the SS is coming to take away all the Jews and kill them, and harboring somebody in their house with a Jew. Do you protect the orphan, the widowless, the homeless from a government that's murdering people, or do you, and you say no, they're not here, or do you commit and knowing what's going to happen to them? But that's a lot different from living your life in such a way where you justify everything situationally and you say, well, if I do this, then this can happen and this is good, so I'm going to do this even though it's going to happen. I mean, it is a slippery slope, and I think you have to stay away from situation ethics.
Okay. Charlie?
I was just going to, I know you're done with the Old Testament for the most part here, but go to Acts 5 with Ananias.
Okay.
Technically, Ananias doesn't lie, or it's not recorded that he lied. And it's a pure deception. And he struck dead. So how do you pull that into, yeah, well, okay, well, that would be the one time deception and lying is wrong. But what is the difference between
what Ananias does and what Gideon does, or what Rahab does, or what Samuel does. Samuel is saying, hey, I'm going to sacrifice this thing to God. Ananias was sacrificing his money to God. What's the difference that you could say, hey, one is okay, and one's not?
Adam, are you going to say something?
Well, I don't know if this fourth solution is really the right approach. It inherently seems dangerous. I have pondered, though, you know, normally when we lie, it's for a selfish motive.
Yeah.
I lie to glorify myself. I lie to present myself in a way that makes me look better than I really am. I certainly am not giving any glory to God when I lie in that way. And certainly that kind of deception is always wrong. The example that Greg gave, you know, like if you're harboring somebody from an evil government, or let's say you're a teacher today and you teach at an elementary school and a gunman has come in and you've hidden a bunch of children and he says, where are the children? I think it would be sinful to say, well, here are the exact locations where I've hidden all the children.
Yeah.
That you become an accomplice to evil. And so sharing information that you know is truthful helps another evil person, if you become an accomplice to that evil, I think that's wrong. Now, if it's me in that situation, ideally, I'm going to try to answer in such a way or not answer in such a way that I'm not literally telling a lie. But, you know, they're not privileged to have to know all the information that
right.
I know. So getting back to Charlie's question, with Ananias and Sapphira, clearly, Ananias was presenting himself in a way that glorified himself in a way that wasn't true. And it robbed God of the glory he deserved. And that's really the real problem there. It's not merely that, well, there's more information he didn't share, like Abraham saying, well, Sarah's my wife, but I didn't tell you she's my sister. It's he's deliberately using Christianity for the purpose of self-glorification. And God hates that.
Yeah. Very, very good thoughts. Jonathan?
I guess I'm skeptical of the approach of looking at this, the critique of saying this is, you know, reading the situation ethics or something like that. There are many, many activities that we could take and say, well, either we've got to put just an absolute blanket condemnation on it because the alternative is situation ethics, where we say that doesn't make any sense. Not all sex is fornication. There's a context in which it's permissible and a context in which it's not. At least, you know, whatever people may think today, at least it's very clear under the law of Moses, not all killing was murder. The law clearly permitted killing in self-defense, you know, someone breaks into your home. So that was not situation ethics. That was understanding these activities are similar, but they're not the same thing. And I don't know what the exact principle would be that we would, you know, draw out of the scriptures for when lying is not sin, however you want to say that, but it's not all wrong. But I don't know that accepting, you know, not all deceit or lying is wrong necessarily means, you know, situation ethics. It means that there is a time in which, you know, it would be appropriate to distinguish between these activities in a way that maybe just our basic word lying doesn't permit us.
What I might say in response to that, and I think you make a very good point there, what I might say in response is that while it might not foundationally lead to the reality of situation ethics being established, I think what it could do is lead to the practice of situation ethics in people's minds. So that someone hears, well, not all lying's wrong. That can kind of flip a switch in someone's mind to think, well, in what cases can I do this then? And so where it doesn't logically establish situation ethics, I think it can practically lead to that. It's kind of what I meant when I said that, at least, if that helps.
My response would be that is not actually, I don't think, logically a refutation of that.
Sure.
Possible explanation. The fact that an explanation might be abused in some way doesn't make it.
Right. That's a fair point. All right, Charlie.
So it adds to their point.
Right. And that's a good point. And again, that's where I would add, who is the author of life and the controller of death? Who is the giver of the sexual relationship in the context of marriage? Who is the father of lies? Not the same person. And so that's where, again, I think there's a distinction to make between lying and some of these other things that can be abused and turned into a sin. Stephen?
I don't know how far back I'm going in the conversation, but you could say that anything is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Not all eating is wrong. But if I say you're eating all day and don't care if other people get any food, or, it becomes gluttony. Sitting in this chair could, for any reason, perpetually, I'm not doing anything else, I'm not serving anybody, I'm not glorifying God. That's not good, but sitting in this chair now.
Sure.
But, you can make a case for anything being wrong in one case and good in another.
Yeah.
But, you have to find some kind of standard for that.
All right. Brian?
Assuming that it's not, then I still think that if you're thinking in terms of loving your neighbor as yourself, there would be very, very few situations in which lying would be even a plausible option. Like saving people from evil government officials.
Like that.
It's not, at least in our lives, practical situation. And so, even if we come to that conclusion, I don't know. No, I'm not sure. But it's not like we're trying to find, in what situation can I lie, kind
right.
of thing. I would say in that situation, we're still leaning more towards, I'm going to avoid lying at all costs.
Yeah.
It's only if I really have to. Maybe.
One more, then we need to wrap up this evening.
This might make it a little bit simpler. Not all speeding is wrong. When is it okay to speed? Is it okay to speed? Okay, I'm speeding because, my wife's a laborer. I'm going, deliver a baby. Is that okay? You're still speeding. You're still breaking the law. I mean, when would we say, speeding is acceptable, under the law, under normal circumstances where, this is your supposed to do them. If you go over, you're technically breaking. Now, put it back in the context of your life. Just because you're breaking the law, you're still breaking the law. So there is no caveat that says, but if you do it, in a pink tutu, hopping on one foot, you're okay. It says lying is wrong.
All right. Well, this is... I should have just stayed in the pulpit and not allowed any discussion. It's been helpful, I think. It's been good discussion, but we're about halfway through, and we're 45 minutes into this now at this point. So I think it's probably be a pretty good stopping point for us, and we'll pick this up next week. But one other thing I was going to add before we wrap up, another solution that's been offered, and we won't take time to discuss this for obvious reasons. But to say that, what we're dealing with here are the mistakes of fallible people. This goes back to the point about Abraham. What it looks, I think, very clearly to the reader is that he's making a mistake. This is not lauded. The narrator doesn't stop and offer moral evaluations of everything, and we're not supposed to read everything in the Old Testament as moral tales for us to follow their every example. However, even this doesn't work as an across-the-board solution, because if nothing else, I mean, whatever you want to do with Rahab, she may fit in kind of the gray area here. You say Abraham's the fallen person. Samuel was told exactly what to say by God and where to go and when to say it. And so that doesn't work as a solution for his situation. Rahab, again, may be somewhere in the middle of that. And so, again, even this, that seems like it could be a very good conclusion, isn't an across-the-board kind of conclusion. So what I'd say about all of the things we've talked about so far this evening, some, I think, are clearly better than others, but none of these really solves all of the situations. And I think that's because not all of the situations are the same. And without wanting to slip into situation ethics itself, I think the solution is not to say, let's find a one-size-fits-all solution for every instance of the Old Testament where there's some moral question about the honesty of the character, and you say one thing and that's going to answer all of them. I just don't think that works. What we need to do is look at each situation individually and try to figure out what's going on there, what's driving the motivations and everything about that. And so what we'll do is next week we'll come back and talk about this some more, but what we'll do is look at these three texts in a little bit more detail and think about what's going on in them and try to find some better answers that way. So that's kind of where we'll be heading. If you'll take your songbook and turn to number 651, we'll sing now this song. If I can make the monitor turn off. There we go. About the 90 and 9 that God is not pleased just to have them. If there is one who is lost, He will do anything to bring that one back. And that's exactly what He did in the sending of Jesus, that none would be lost if we would but turn to Him. And so that's the invitation that we offer. If you just turn to God, if you turn to Christ, there is salvation waiting for you. And if there's any way that we can help you this evening, won't you let it be known as we stand and sing together.